Welcome to Voices. I'm Alan Wilcox, Editor-in-Chief of Epidemiology. In 2002, the journal began a project to interview our field's most senior and accomplished practitioners. In these interviews, scientists reflect on their careers, their professional influences, and on the future of epidemiology. The interview you're about to hear is with Olli Miettinen. Dr. Miettinen invigorated epidemiologic theory with key publications in the 1960s and 1970s. These papers introduced novel approaches to study design, effect estimation, and causal inference that have become part of modern epidemiologic methods. Dr. Miettinen is a respected teacher of epidemiologic theory and has made substantial contributions to cardiovascular disease epidemiology and cancer screening. This interview was conducted by Jim Hanley in 2011.
I'm Jim Hanley, and welcome Dr. Miettinen to this, on behalf of the Journal of Epidemiology, to this interview. As you know, the plan is that the responses you give to the 13 core questions and any amplification of those will be printed in the journal. And I'm hoping the journal will also be generous enough to see the point of maybe making space for answers to additional questions that I have on slightly different topics. But I don't know what's going to happen with that. We're just producing the source document at the moment, and I see the epidemiologists wanting to have a source document to keep. The purpose, as I see it, is basically here to get your views on things that may not be evident or covered in your writings, the extensive writings, and in your addresses to congresses and so on. And also, of course, to put your in perspective your half century of serious work in this field. The half century, by the way, I'm counting, doing the numbers as a good epidemiologist, 25 or 6 of them have been here at McGill University. Right?
Quarter century.
Quarter century.
One third.
And at Harvard before that?
From 66 to 86.
Two decades there. Very good. But obviously, looking back, I also want you to look ahead to what you think is in store or should be in store for epidemiology and for our profession. And your advice for the next generation on how young people should prepare themselves for a career in our profession. Okay, so let's start. The first question that the journal wants me to ask is about your entry into epidemiology. But I want to go back to your entry into the world itself. And it's going to be on the web what your age is. You were born in 1936. Okay, so you're coming up on 75. So if you could tell us a little bit about yourself as for nature and nurture, if you know what I mean, and other early influences. And let me be more specific. How much education did your parents have, for example?
My father had his doctorate in theology, of all things.
Wow.
My mother was a teacher, and my aunts and teachers all around. Yeah.
I see.
And so it was a home of education. My father was the head of the high school section of the State Board of Education.
With a degree in a doctorate in theology?
You bet.
What did he hope to do with it when he got started?
He was going to be a professor, but he got distracted to education.
I see. And how comfortable was your childhood? This was before the war, right? During the war.
I was really born in my conscious age to war
Is
circumstances.
Right? Yeah.
And so we were in the countryside. Father was at war, and it was great.
Father was at war.
Oh, sure.
In the
war. Okay. So it was great deprivation in every way.
Uh-huh.
And then we moved to Helsinki in 1944 when I was 8 years of age.
Okay.
And studied my formal education late in that way.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And there are many siblings?
We are a total of 7.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay. So it was a deprived childhood in the sense of the material things.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. And further, now that you ask essentially about happiness, I did not like the theological environment.
I see.
It was too stringent and limited to my taste.
I see. Okay. Now, others that have been interviewed in this series have mentioned an aptitude or a liking for mathematics. I imagine you liked it too, did you? Was it one of your favorite subjects, or that subject to be tolerated?
Mathematics and physics.
Physics, okay.
My teacher of physics turns to the class and says, "You people should take interest in this subject like I and Miettinen do."
Oh.
Mathematics, and in fact, my first academic endeavor was technological physics. And my livelihood was a matter of teaching mathematics.
I see.
Subsequently, to those who were applying for the technology school.
Got
you. So mathematics has been very much a preoccupation.
And not alone that, is it a prerequisite? Serious mathematics a prerequisite for our profession? Or are you overtrained in that sense?
I am broadly of the mind that whereas in physics, a physicist uneducated in mathematics without serious education in mathematics is unimaginable.
Yeah, yeah.
But in medical science, to my great consternation, really, you can be a scientist without education in statistics. You delegate such a central thing to a lateral profession.
I see.
That shouldn't be. There should be the integration of statistics with the rest.
Okay. Now, the other prerequisite, I would think, is languages or language. Which languages do you have a good reading knowledge of?
Mother tongue, of course, is Finnish.
Right.
Swedish was an official language.
Yeah.
So one had to develop fluency in Swedish. I did get to be quite fluent in German, which was a good part of the medical textbook's content. Oh. And I still communicate in German. Now, French, only a tiny bit of exposure. I liked it, but I did not go deep into it.
But you could read it, eh?
I can pretty well read professional content.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I had a teacher come to my house on Saturdays in Boston to teach me French. But then one day I asked, why am I doing this?
I was still in Boston. In preparation for coming
No, before.
Oh.
And so I, in life, often ask, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
And the answer was vanity, so that in the restaurant you can speak with the garçon and so on. So I quit.
I see.
Yeah.
I see. Which writers have most...
By the way, English, of course, was a major
subject
of study.
Yeah, from early on.
It was a bit delayed because there was a transition from German major to English major, and the textbooks were not available early on. But yeah, I took great interest in the English language.
I know that, yeah. What writers have most influenced your style of, your own style of writing, if you have any that you'd want to mention? And in English or in German or any other?
Well, English is what matters.
Okay.
And I cannot say that I develop style from some particular author, but I take a great note of their way of writing, nevertheless.
Yeah.
And I try to improve my writing, but as you know, so often readers say that it is difficult to capture my writing's meaning. But of course the question is, where's the problem? Is the problem in the writing or is it in the reading? Some of these things require a certain level of preparedness to even seriously read. And so I am open to guidance as to how to write better, but I am as serious a writer as anyone that I can think of from the point of view of the flow of the content, the logic of the presentation.
Now, after high school, you've mentioned some of this already. After high school, was there army service?
Yes, there was.
There was, which you had to do.
Compulsory. Yes.
And then, so you didn't go directly. You went from high school to army, and then to.
I went to technology, the technological physics, for a year.
Right.
And then I went to the military, and then to medicine.
Oh, okay.
And a tremendous difference between technology studies and medical studies. In technology, you really have very serious studies of very substantive content.
Right.
And in medicine, you just lean back as though sitting in a train and waiting to get to the end station years down the pike.
I see.
So leisurely as for any intellection.
Yeah. But given that, why did you choose medical school and switch from physics? That wasn't your father,
When in technology, I had this thought that whereas as a school kid, I had always been told by others that this boy will be an engineer because he was so into technology, inventions, endeavors, and constructing things, that it was an outside idea that he is going to be an engineer. And classmates, half a dozen of us, went to technology. Nobody went to medicine. So it was a little bit of thoughtless sort of submission to expectations.
I see. Yeah. But then coming back from the army, you went to medical school.
Medicine, yeah.
And was that with the idea of being in medical research or being a clinician?
The thing was, and I think it today still is, that when you enter medical school, there is no telling as to what you will do when you grow up.
Right.
There are so many lines of endeavor that I was quite uncommitted, other than I was going to be a physician, practitioner.
You were?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah.
But seeing then, individual patients, you mean?
Yeah. But then I was drawn to research as a medical student, and that gave me the impulse to actually something else.
That's we're coming up now to the first question the journal has posed to you, and that is indeed to describe your own path, how your own path brought you into epidemiology, how you went from medicine in general to epidemiology in particular. So might you give us some sense of that?
Yeah, as a medical student, I was drawn into research in a private hospital setting and foundation, engaged in cardiologic research. And I got this strong impression that something is fundamentally wrong in this research. Mm-hmm. That these researchers, medical people from professor on down, while they were concerned with statistics suitably entered into their papers, they had no interest in what these statistics are and what they mean and so on. There was just a way of entering them into your paper like the other papers that you read something. And the
it hasn't changed.
And the statisticians would be in an other institute. Okay. And they would get the data and produce these statistics to be somehow worked into your article. I thought that this divorce between the substance and the statistics was just inappropriate, wholly inappropriate. And so either I leave academic medicine, which is what I was headed for, or I become a student of these very things. And after some consternation and contemplation, I elected to set out to try to learn theory of medical research, notably applied medical research.
Okay. And then that
And I was advised then to go and study epidemiology and biostatistics.
In Minnesota?
Well, that was the principle. Epidemiology and biostatistics is what you have to do.
Right.
Now, if you want to do it right, you go to those United States of America. Mm-hmm. And I did that.
I see. To the University of Minnesota.
Yeah.
Yeah. To a program which had both epidemiology and biostatistics in the one department?
No, separate departments.
Separate. And it was called biostatistics at that point?
It got to be biometry later on. So when I got my PhD, the department was already biometry. It was biostatistics when I entered.
It was. Okay. So that, okay.
Yeah.
Was there extensive coursework and mentoring at the University of Minnesota, or would you consider yourself to be self-taught, if you know what I mean?
Well, let me answer that by saying that once I was done with my education, I took every course in epidemiology and in statistics, mm-hmm. biostatistics included, and some lateral courses in genetics and so on. And at the end of it, I had the same feeling as I had at the end of medical school. I have spent this time here studying something, but I have not learned that which I have studied. Medical school, I was officially the top student, but I felt I did not learn medicine. I had my PhD in biometry and epidemiology minor, and I felt that I had not learned the principles of such research as I was concerned with. Mm-hmm. So that it remained a matter of future development rather than having been in the bag.
You're all ready to go.
Education.
Yeah.
That to me is a problem, that education fails to educate.
I see. What epidemiology?
I'm not saying that they were any worse than anybody else.
Right.
It's just the
nature
of the beast.
Yeah, exactly. Now, what epidemiology textbooks were available to you during your graduate study?
The sort of more advanced book was that of McMahon, Pugh, and Ibsen, mm-hmm. 1960, Epidemiologic Methods.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And statistics hasn't changed that much, so the...
No, not that much. And there was peculiarly then nothing in the nature of epidemiologic statistics, or, if you will, clinical statistics. You would have bioassay and you would have sampling theory and things like this, but nothing by way of statistics as it pertains to a certain line of research other than bioassay.
Right. But you did tell me that you were one of the first to carry Mantell's work from Minnesota, where you probably encountered it, to Harvard.
But that
others.
Was not from my teachings. It was from my
studies. Exactly. But he was one of the first to get into epidemiologic statistics, I would say. Right?
Who was?
Mantell.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. In the 50s already.
Yeah.
In the 70s, Mantell said to me that you are the only one who really understands the Mantel-Hensel test. You know that the competitor was the Cochrane test.
Yes, exactly.
But the Cochrane test had a flaw, notably in respect to very thin strata, such as matched pairs, where the error is by a factor of two. So, but Mantell evidently was frustrated with his test being ignored.
Yeah.
And when I came to Harvard, I brought the news about Mantell-Hensel to Harvard.
Yeah. You also told me once a conversation you had with Mantell about the reason for the weights in the product, and how it was news to me that AD over BC itself, without any weight, would produce a sum of those over a sum of those would produce an median unbiased estimate.
Quite so. But the question is about the weighting.
Exactly.
And you agree that his weighting was very ingenious.
Yes.
In that the product grows in proportion to the square of the total. And now you have to divide by the square of the total.
To get it right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Not the square, but the total itself.
Yeah. And just a footnote on that is that some years ago, Clayton worked out that, in fact, that formulation that he came up with has great theoretical rationale behind it. It's the first iteration on the way to maximum likelihood. It was turned out.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So Mantell himself did not quite understand how profound it was.
But his instincts were outstanding.
As he would have testified himself.
Oh, yes. He wasn't shy.
No. He was realistic.
Now we're coming to the second one, which is the biggest difference between epidemiology that was practiced when you began your career and epidemiology today. what are the biggest differences?
Epidemiology as a concept remains confused as to whether it means practice of epidemiology, which to me is community medicine.
Okay, well, let's start
or epidemiological
that.
Research.
Right, we'll but start you, with the first, yeah.
But
yeah.
If we want to talk about practice of community medicine, the principal difference that I am concerned with is that increasingly we have this idea around that a citizen ought to take care of their own health in the interest of society. And healthcare increasingly encroaches on individual freedoms. In Nazi Germany, the citizen had the responsibility to take care of their health in the interest of the Reich. And we are in that situation increasingly today, and it bothers me as a libertarian.
I see. Well, I remember when you came to McGill first, I remember you used to smoke a pipe.
Yeah.
And you were pretty annoyed at some of the public health laws. Are you talking about tobacco smoking as one of those?
That's preeminent, but yeah. There are other things today, but that is surely the preeminent theme.
Right.
And it was in Nazi Germany.
I see. Yeah, I remember in particular the business about smoking in your office. Might I ask how many years you smoked tobacco yourself? I know we shouldn't ask professors to profess about public policy at the same time. But
I can't be clear because it's so off and on kind of theme.
I see.
As a youngster and medical student, everybody would smoke in the class,
right.
Would you believe?
Right.
As medical students.
Yeah.
And so that was part of the environment.
Culture. Yeah.
And then once the report came out in 1964, the Smoking and Health, and my professor quit from 2 packs a day to 0, so did I.
Oh.
I didn't smoke 2 packs, but
I quit. Yeah.
And so it's been so irregular that you couldn't get a smoking history out of me.
I see.
With
I
any
see.
Credibility.
I remember the ritual of the with it. But I always thought when I grew up that a pipe smoker was a wise man. And that's what I remember you coming to McGill as, the pipe smoker.
Well, think of Einstein, for instance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, so you gave it up fairly easily?
Oh, sure. Mm.
Now, so you're telling me your smoking history wouldn't really make you eligible for the recent studies and screening for lung cancer then? You didn't smoke that much, did you?
Oh, no. But again, I don't see any thresholds for eligibility.
I see.
If I were very health preoccupied, I would go and get screened, but I am not very health preoccupied.
I see, because you have a very good opportunity with the collaborators
to be
you
sure.
have. But you never considered it?
No.
Do you think this screening for lung cancer should be covered by our Canadian and our Quebec healthcare system?
This is a question of public policy, mm-hmm. and public policy is not at all my line.
Mm-hmm.
And further, I have the view, and I am not by any means alone in this, that researchers should not express themselves in mm-hmm. respect to public policy. I asked Richard Doll about this, and he had a different view. He thought that a researcher should speak up about public policy, but I am in a different camp.
Mm-hmm,
I have nothing to say as to what society should or should not.
Well, I was going to ask you that later. So you don't think it's okay for researchers to be involved in public health policy then?
That's very much my point.
Yeah. Yes, but you spoke of your own professor giving up and then you gave up. Brian McMahon said the same thing a few years ago, about 20 years ago now, about drinking coffee. He was very wrong, but a lot of people took notice of him at the time. So these public figures do have a chance to influence something and to do it, go wrong or go right. Yeah, so there's a big responsibility there, I think.
I don't know. It seems to me that there is no moral underpinning to somebody's lifestyle
with
respect to smoking or anything else.
The second, that was part one, which is epidemiology as public health practice or community medicine, right?
Hmm.
Then the second one?
As for epidemiological research, since my beginning in epidemiology, the volume has increased enormously. But the question is, how much progress has there been in the achievements? Mm-hmm. As you know, today, the remedy for almost everything from the preventive point of view is diet and exercise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Question, what have we learned about diet and exercise in these 50 years? And I'm afraid not so much. So volume increase without a whole lot of progress in knowledge. That's my impression about the change.
Yeah, yeah. Along the diet and exercise line, a few years ago you lent me the book by Gary Tobes on good calories, bad calories, and I was very impressed by how extensively you had marked it up and how carefully you had followed his arguments. And I take it that you have pretty high regard for his work, do you?
There are two things here. I was very much preoccupied with cardiovascular disease epidemiology as I was on my way to become a professor of cardiology back in Helsinki.
Right.
And so I went to these congresses and I followed everything quite closely and was really quite disappointed with, again, the progress. We could constantly listen to three main risk factors in these conferences, but no understanding of why the epidemic was rising and then turned to decline. Very frustrating. Now, when Tobes looks into the topic, he plows deep historically in respect to matters, epidemiologic, geographic observations and whatever over the centuries. And he delves deep into the biology of atherogenesis and related things. And so the breadth and depth of his scholarship relative to what I think characterizes cardiovascular disease epidemiologists, at least in my experience in those olden days, this to me was very impressive and to me shows how one should approach cancer epidemiology, for example, really understanding the biology and history rather than just recent epidemiological research. And so Gary Taub, who, by the way, is not
he's a science writer. That's right. Yeah.
But he does his work with diligence and depth and breadth. Very impressive.
Now, I asked you about smoking and so on. What counsel do you follow yourself in the area of diet and exercise? I know you're a keen sportsman, but as for diet, does it matter or is it private?
I don't think of diet in my own case from the health point of view.
No, okay.
My aunt taught me that poor people's children are omnivores.
I see. Okay, fair enough. Okay, so let's switch now to the question of which person would you single out as having most strongly influenced your career?
There's no question. As you remember now, I, as a medical student, came to this idea that maybe I should study theory of medical research, and I consulted Martti Karvonen, my professor of physiology.
In Helsinki?
Yeah. And he was the one who advised me to study epidemiology and biostatistics and to go to the United States to that end. So he is the one person, obviously, and eminently.
And there you encountered, that's where Ansel Keys was, right?
He was another physiologist.
Was he? Yeah. And he's one of the ones that Tobes is not too happy with, I think. Right. Yeah.
Karvonen collaborated with Keys on this seven countries study.
Right.
And the seven countries study brought us, I think, essentially two themes: serum cholesterol as something to worry about, and the Mediterranean diet to think of as the preferable diet. Italy was one of the seven settings in that study.
Yeah.
And again, not a whole lot of progress since those early days.
No.
But yes, Tobes is highly critical of matters around this and many other matters in nutritional epidemiology.
Exactly. But I did hear you once describe Key's classroom teaching style.
It sounds like it was a joy. Huh? Uniquely impressive.
It reminds me of your own a little bit.
Well, you are so generous here. But to teach based on your own research is unusual to begin with. But to do that with full presentation of what the critics are saying and answering your critics in class, this is a unique experience to me in my education. So whether he was right or whether he was wrong is beside the point.
Exactly.
The process was highly academic as far as I'm concerned.
Are there any persons, one who put you on the path to epidemiology, are there any persons who've strongly influenced your thinking about the concepts of epidemiology and about principles and methods, which has been your own life career? Or again, is that mainly from yourself?
I have to say that the statistics from Mantell mainly surely were very strong exogenous influences. Cochrane also, both of whom I knew quite closely in those early years. But as for epidemiological research, I had, as a PhD student already, considerable criticisms of what was said by my professor McMahon at Harvard in his book. So that it was clear that the development was very incomplete.
I see.
So I can't say that I have really had strong inputs from epidemiological thinkers.
Philosophers maybe, but...
That's quite another thing. Karl Popper, first and foremost, but many others.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, of course, philosophers can be very misguided. There's been a lot of nonsense.
Now, what have you found to be the most important ingredients of a good collaboration? I know this doesn't apply particularly to you as much as it does to some of the others who have been interviewed, but...
Well, my collaboration has been as a consultant, as an advisor, and in that role, it seems to me that the first order principle should be a deference to your client, your consultee, so that you are a student, a patient student of their own thinking as to what their topic seems to be and how they plan to study it, including really delving into their motives as to why they want to do this. And then again, you patiently, slowly lead them to formulate the object of study in a more detailed and in a meaningful way, and similarly the means of studying it. And I have this idea that ideally, in the end, your consultee would have the idea that they designed the study all the way without anybody's help. So you are there like Socrates, sort of guiding their thinking rather than imposing your thinking.
With whom have you had the best collaborations then?
I must say with Herschel Gick, the father of pharmacoepidemiology. He was so impressive, vast knowledge of pharmacology and medicine for one, great mastery of his enormous database, complex and voluminous, and commitment to excellence in everything, including making the very best of consultation inputs. And sort of an indication of this was the music that was continually playing in his office. Only Mozart was good enough. So that's what it was, without any exceptions whatsoever. Amadeus, God's beloved, was the only one who qualified. So that was an exercise in excellence and high academia, in my view, more than anything else.
In the research on lung cancer screening that I've alluded to, was your role as more a consultant or a collaborator there, I think?
There was an initiative in the thoracic medicine segment of Cornell Medical at that time, in the beginning of the 90s, where the concern was to find a common theme of research for the different specialties in thoracic medicine. And so they had a retreat in Snowbird, Utah, mm-hmm. and they invited me to be an observer and analyst as to what's happening. And so as I had listened to the presentations from the different specialties, I diagnosed CT screening for lung cancer as being their shared concern, and they quickly adopted that advice. And I there already told them that I am not thinking of this in the ordinary epidemiological terms of a randomized trial, mm-hmm. but rather as a program of multiple clinical medical questions to be addressed as a complex program where you set out to do the screening and you develop the whole way of conducting the screening, and then you learn about its diagnostic consequences, and you learn about the prognostic consequences of such novel early diagnosis mm-hmm. that you arrive at. So I have been sort of the progenitor of the very idea
okay.
and its principles, and I have then been an advisor to them again almost two decades now.
Mm-hmm. And how satisfying has that role been?
It is a bit of a problem in that there is such a dogmatic epidemiologic commitment to those randomized trials on the mistaken notion that screening is an intervention. And so there is a lot of flack that comes then from the dogmatists. Mm. And this, by the way, James, you asked me about this thing on the wall in my office. Students have given me this thing that has Einstein's facade there, and underneath are these words as a quote from Einstein saying, and I am embarrassed to say that because I don't think of myself as being anybody's Einstein, but the words are these: great spirits have always encountered violent opposition from mediocre minds. I cannot help but this comes to mind mm-hmm. repeatedly when dealing with the dogmatism of epidemiology in relation to screening, where, by the way, screening in epidemiological thought is thought to be preventive medicine when it is early diagnosis rather than prevention. And so much is amiss around. So that makes me unhappy. But at the same time, the progress of the research has been gratifying. And the people involved with semi-annual international conferences and so on have all been very, very committed.
When you spoke earlier of JIC, you spoke of pharmacoepidemiology. And a number of young epidemiologists that I've talked to, they shy away from pharmacoepidemiology on the grounds that one is too easily corrupted by industry and by government money as well. What would you say to them, these young people?
Well, first of all, I appreciate your question where you refer to students as worrying about corruption by government.
Mm-hmm. Well,
this is not very well appreciated that National Institutes of Health in the United States has all sorts of policies emanating from the institutes themselves, mm-hmm. such as randomized trials in diagnostics, mm-hmm. Radiologic diagnostics in particular, cancer diagnostics. So government can be profoundly misguided and misleading, therefore, researchers, and industry, of course, is well known in this respect. My view is that I don't care who pays for your research. I care of what you say, what your evidence is. To me, it is totally irrelevant who sponsored your research. The question is, tell me about the research, rather than about the sponsorship.
So, in general, you think it's possible then for epidemiologists and biostatisticians to tread that fine line between truth and money?
No. If there is somebody sponsoring your pursuit of truth, mm-hmm. whether it is industry or government, and whatever may be their corrupt ideas bothers me not in the least, so long as you stay on the straight and narrow.
Mm-hmm. And you think that's possible?
Oh, yeah.
I expect that you've been approached many times yourself by lawyers and industry types for paid advice on matters epidemiologic. And how do you decide whether, and if you do, which ones to get involved in?
Sometimes half a dozen lawyers come to my office at Harvard,
mm-hmm.
And of course also here, including, by the way, tobacco people. No, I don't get involved in these things.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't particularly mind answering questions for them again to make whatever they care to make of. But that's not really their concern. They want you to be in person there in a court of law. Mm-hmm. And I just refrain from that totally, have never appeared in court.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I stay out of it.
I see. Now, going back now to another main topic, whom would you regard as the two or three most important epidemiologists during your lifetime?
I take it that the question is about epidemiological research rather than epidemiological practice of community
yeah.
medicine. If I were asked about all time instead of my lifetime,
mm-hmm.
then I would say very obviously Edward Jenner and Robert Koch, the principal epidemiological scientists. But if you ask about my actual lifetime,
mm-hmm.
then I would say, sort of a little bit uncertain, but I would say, how about Franz Müller and Richard Doll and Ernst Winder in different roles? Franz Müller, 1939, publishes his medical thesis and beautifully demonstrates how very high is the risk of lung cancer from smoking. The epidemic was well recognized as being on the ascendancy from the beginning of the century, but for once it was understood that smoking is the explanation of the epidemic. Now, Richard Doll had a major role in retarding the understanding of this in the UK, and Winder and others in the United States similarly had a role in retarding this understanding. It was only in 1964 that the Smoking and Health Report of the Surgeon General in the United States came out, and even that wasn't all that readily received. So, notably, my own professor of epidemiology was on the committee, and he was smoking 2 packs a day, but he said, so long as the committee work is incomplete, I will not change my smoking habits so as to not give a hint of what the results are. Notice, still uncertain, looking to what the truth is. And then when actually the report came out, he cold turkey went from 2 packs to zero and stayed at zero. But the professor of biostatistics, Pete Behrman, put a poster on his wall saying, it has now been proven beyond any reasonable doubt that smoking is the main cause of statistics. Yeah. I'm just saying that in the mid-60s, still, there was this thing. And as you know, your R.A. Fisher spent his sunset years trying to show that smoking does not cause lung cancer. So there was a tremendous slowness in the countries in the post-war period in accepting what was well shown and quite obvious before the war.
You're the first one I've heard to say that Dahl and Winder retarded it. My understanding is that the industry was the one who kept the controversy alive for as long as they could. Why do you say Dahl?
Winder, for instance, in 1950, still concludes that it looks as though there could be an effect, but there was nothing of the sort of obvious major effect in 1950 as published by Winder, for instance. Now, Dahl in 1950 was a bit ahead of this, but still not ready to declare that there is a major, major effect on risk of lung cancer. Mm. So that there was, and by the way, he visited Germany in the 30s, Dahl did, and knew as to what was going on. And replicating Müller's study would have been a quick thing to do, but no, you get into these very long-term, very massive studies, and you have to wait for years and this and that. It was apparently, as far as I can tell, really a slowing, retarding process. Whether intentional, I can't say.
Yeah, yeah. He did reference, he referenced the German work, I think, indirectly, didn't he, in the first paper?
I think he did. I can't say, but it was, actually, the abstract was published in JAMA in 1939.
Oh, okay.
Already.
But I do remember one of the statements there was maybe it's air pollution, maybe it's the tarmacadam, maybe it's this new asphalt we're putting down. That was one of
there were these ideas. Yeah. And as you know, the lung cancer topic was being closed in 1964 in the U.S.
Yeah, yeah.
It was remarkably slow. Yeah. And as I say, my professor was smoking two packs a day.
So we're talking here about epidemiology scientists, as you say, that you'd regard as the most important. Besides yourself, who would you regard as the most important teachers of theoretical epidemiology? Do you see any others worthy of that name?
I have no notion to the effect that I am the preeminent teacher. I am probably the most experienced. Taught more courses internationally than anybody else. But I'm not saying that I am the number one teacher from the content point of view. But I, again, am not familiar with what the teachings are in the other courses. And so I just don't know who the top teachers in the aggregate are.
Yeah. No, I don't mean teachers in the classroom sense. I mean in the writer sense.
Oh, do you mean developers or textbook authors?
Yeah, textbook authors. Yeah, yeah, that type of teacher. Yeah.
Now, as you would agree, the leading teacher today in textbook terms and even as for coursework, probably clearly is my student Rothman. As for his teachings in the sense of his writings, I find it interesting that he still has cohort study and case control study, which in my view should be themes of the past. They do not deserve to be presented as modern ideas about epidemiological research. So there is a certain stagnancy there, lack of moving with the understandings.
Now, to come on to your own work, which do you think has been your most influential paper?
This ties up with the very question you just asked. Mm-hmm. If I need to pick one, it really should be probably that 1976 paper on case reference studies, a citation classic it is. And the eminence of it insofar as influence is concerned is perhaps principally because of the test-based interval estimate concept that was presented there. But I might add, the question there is about under evaluated studies, and I think this is the most under evaluated studies, underappreciated study, really, in that there the case control study concept should have had the beginning of its end, but it didn't. In that paper, it is said as a novelty that the so-called control group really should be understood to be a sample of the study base. And once it is a sample of the study base, which is the referent of the study result, study base is the referent, why now then you don't compare your case series with your base series. You get numerator information from one and denominator information from the other, and you get to quasi rates and their ratios without any rare disease assumption and all this. So again, to repeat, this is what the world has not yet learned, that the idea of comparing cases with controls is not what really should be done. One should understand that you need a numerator series and a denominator series, and you don't compare them. No, you derive rate ratios from them without any need for rare disease assumption. So case control study should be passé by now. And by the way, confounding, which is the alternative to causation, as you so well know. The Surgeon General's report did not yet have the word confounding there in 1964. But I say, when confounding is the alternative to causality, confounding can never be understood without the concept of study base. If you have case group and control group, and now the question is, what's a confounder? There is no answer to that question. An author of a textbook on case control studies was in my office, and I asked him, hey, how did you define confounding in your textbook? And there was a pause, and then I don't remember. I had the thought quietly that it's difficult to remember something that makes no sense. Case control study is an aberration that really should disappear, and there's something aberrant about cohort study as well. So stagnation prevails also in the theory of epidemiological research.
Just to read into the record here as well, another person who got it right, and that's Barnett Wolff in 1955, said the same thing, and he's been ignored as well. I mean, he was writing outside of epidemiology, so there's an excuse there. But he, if I go back on his words, they're identical to yours about numerator series, denominator series, and this kind of artifact is avoided if one works with incident rates in the two groups. Clear as day, you know. He uses the funny genetics for small letters for numerators and capital letters for denominators.
Yeah.
And then it's very clear. That paper, though, the 1976 paper, has a lot of material in it, and there are many gems in it, and I think some of them have indeed, I agree with you, some of them have been lost. If you had a chance to do that paper over again, would you do anything differently?
Yes. You already say that there is too much mm-hmm. in it.
Mm-hmm.
So that effective writing really, I think, focuses on component topics one at a time instead of aggregating them the way it was done there. And that said, if I now imagine what really should have been the one and only theme at mm-hmm. that time, mm-hmm. it should have been this theme of let's move beyond case control study. Mm-hmm. Let's learn to be students of rates. Let's compare exposed with unexposed rather than cases with controls. And it is not an arbitrary option to compare, do one thing or the other. You really must be committed to comparing the exposed with the unexposed mm-hmm. as for rates. Comparing cases with controls is nonsense.
That paper also introduced one of the many terms that you brought into epidemiology, and that's the word incidence density. And I asked you recently why you felt the need to invent the term incidence density when others like Edmonds and Farr in the early 19th century were already using terms like rate and force of morbidity, force of mortality. What's wrong with something like event rate or transition rate? So do you want to repeat your answer here?
Let's first understand that we are talking about incidence rather than prevalence.
For sure.
Rate.
For sure.
But there is no singularity for incidence rate. There is a proportion type incidence, which is a dimensionless mm-hmm. quantity like prevalence rate mm-hmm. is. Mm-hmm. And then there is incidence density with its inverse time dimensionality. So it is a peculiar sub-concept under the concept of incidence rate. And so it needs a term that is more specific. Now, yes, I was, of course, well aware of force of morbidity, which is in that density mode, inverse time mode, no question. But why force? Now you could say force of incidence. Well, does that distinguish between this and the proportion type rate? And why force? I grew up largely, as you know, in statistics, and I have probability density as sort of a model. And in science at large, density is a very common concept. And so now we have incident phenomena, events. Incidence rates are about events, not states. Mm-hmm. And so event density is
our event rate?
Well, but in the particular meaning of density, because as I say, proportion type incidence is also a rate.
True.
So rate doesn't cut it with the appropriate specificity. You have to be specific density.
If I use the word transition rate, it would bring out the idea of sweeping over time.
Transition now refers to the fact that at issue is an event. Event is a transitional event.
Yeah.
But that, when you say transition rate, then I would just as well say event rate. But there are two kinds of event rate, the proportion type rate and then the density type rate in the inverse time mm-hmm. sense. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I have no regrets about that.
Okay.
But that could have been another paper.
Yes. This term incidence density sampling is used a lot nowadays. What do you think of that?
I have not adopted that at all. Now, it probably has its origins in that 76 paper, but the whole point is that when your study base is population time, a dynamic population time, then you sample that for your denominator series. There's nothing special about the sampling itself. If there's anything special, it is the nature of the study base, namely a dynamic population. So that's what you are sampling.
Yes.
But it's not that you have a peculular way of sampling.
Yeah.
You sample what you must sample.
Yeah, I have the same sense.
So it's not a sampling option.
I have the same sense that it's a misinterpretation. Mm. Yeah. What other terms did you bring into epidemiology, or is the list too long?
I'm afraid that the latter is the correct answer, but we are here, for instance, talking about comparisons. Index category, reference category in the causal contrast, to be sure, is one of these. But
effect modification, is that yours?
Well, confounding is not a novelty of mine, but it was novelty to epidemiology when I introduced it. Of course, I drew it from Fisher as a term. But in around 1970, still, in epidemiology, there was utter confusion between those two topics of confounding and modification. And I, in response to whatever other piece was topical at the time, I made that distinction between modification and confounding. And those terms, of course, have stuck. But I say again that the confounding is not an innovation of mine. It was established by Fisher.
Mm-hmm. Now, which of your contributions to the field would you most like to be remembered for?
There are people who think about how they are thought of posthumously. I am not one of those. I'm here and now, and I don't care what is thought or said afterwards. But if I should surmise as to what might be the subject of note in those posthumous days of mine, I really think that they would focus on the books that I've been working on for the last 2.5 years, really. Two books just came out, one on clinical epidemiology and EBM, and the other one, a counterpart of the Dictionary of Epidemiology. And right now I'm working on an introductory text on epidemiological research, and I expect to have that complete by the end of this year. And next year I may still produce an introductory text on clinical research, which has been my other preoccupation in addition to epidemiological research. So I think that if there is any attention to the man when he's gone, it might center on these books, which really represent a synopsis of the understandings that I have achieved over the decades now, and focus really on what ultimately matters, namely the elementary. These are not advanced topics, any one of them, they are elementary.
Mm-hmm. Now, the book in particular that I'm struck by is the one, Epidemiologic Research, Terms and Concepts. Is that the right term, the right title?
Quite so.
Yeah. And the arrangement of topics in that book is, to me, very interesting and appealing. And for those who haven't yet bought the book or seen the reviews or looked it up on Amazon, might you give us just a small preview of the contents there and the arrangement?
Yeah. Your questions have already brought up the issue of whether there are preliminaries that are necessary for entry into a line of study. Mm-hmm. For instance, if your study is physics, you surely must have a strong background in mathematics. Now, if your endeavor is going to be epidemiological research as we know it, now you have certain preliminaries that you need to think about. There is terms and concepts of medicine for one, terms and concepts of science for another, and third, statistics. All these things, ideally, in an orientational way, are in the bag when you enter into your epidemiology studies. And so in that particular dictionary, if you want to think of it that way, there is a section for each of these preliminaries first. Mm-hmm. And then there is a section for actual epidemiological research. And then there is yet another section for something that I term meta-epidemiological clinical research. There's clinical research that is not of the epidemiological form, and there's clinical research that is of the epidemiological form, and that constitutes the fourth segment. And so I have endeavored to classify terms and concepts in these terms first, and then under the actual epidemiology and meta-epidemiological sections, I distinguish or try to distinguish between topics that have to do with object of study as distinct from methods of study. Because one of my big themes for years and years now has been the inattention in epidemiological research to object design. Everybody is a methodologist, study designer from the methods point of view, without any pride or even thought of being a designer of what to study exactly. And I might add that I have come to the view that the object design should lead you all the way to your statistical model, multivariate statistical model, so that so-called data analysis is no longer a topic I would care to teach, because most of it is covered under object design. And model fitting is today a minor exercise. And so object design versus methods design, an added distinction in those two sections. So it's the architecture that is quite unusual.